So we're a minute early. Are you waiting for anybody else to join us this morning?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Meyer, anyone else coming? You're muted.
Not that I know of.
Okay. Well, let's call the next case. We'll have the marshal reconvene court.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Reyes, Judge Bratvold, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 9, 2021. We're here on our second of four cases on our calendar this morning. Sorry, five cases on our calendar this morning. 821-0808 Woodward versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, a few housekeeping matters. I'll ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal will show a running clock of your time. You will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant John Woodward. The district court said there was no need for an evidentiary hearing for essentially two reasons. Reason one is that it would be pointless because even if there was a hearing, Woodward cannot satisfy the taken by surprise prong of the Larison test. Reason two is because the claim is untimely. Concluding no hearing is needed because Woodward cannot satisfy the Larison prong is either a misunderstanding of or ignores Minnesota Supreme Court case law stating that prong is never used to deny relief. And I would direct the court to cases such as Ferguson v. State, which is 645 Northwest 2nd, 437, the Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2002, and Martin v. State, which is 825 Northwest 2nd, 734 from Minnesota Supreme Court in 2013, which are cited in Mr. Woodward's materials, which stand for that proposition.
Mr. Longsdorf, excuse me. So do we even need to get to the Larison test? I mean, don't we start with the statutory time bar issue under 590.01 as to whether or not the petition for post-conviction relief had been filed in a timely basis in the first instance?
I think they're both relevant to the analysis because if a petition is ultimately frivolous, then there's no need for an evidentiary hearing one way or another. But we do contend that Mr. Woodward's claims satisfy both the newly discovered evidence and the interest of justice exceptions to the time bar.
So before we get to the time bars, would you agree that the post-conviction petition that had been filed in 2021 is not timely because the statutory bar started running actually in March 22nd of 2012, correct?
I would agree that it's outside of the 2 years after the conviction became final, and so therefore we must satisfy one of the exceptions to the time bar, either the newly discovered evidence or the interest of justice.
Okay.
And I'm sorry if I cut you off.
I'm sorry, I just said thank you. Thank you for that clarification because I wasn't quite sure on that point. So,
okay. And so the reason the district court has said that this can't satisfy either the interest of justice or the newly discovered evidence exceptions is because Mr. Woodward said in a hearing, I think in 2012, that he had heard that McPhillips was recanting, which the district court concluded that means McPhillips' extensive recantation, in which she lays out that nearly all of her testimony was false and explains exactly why she testified falsely in the first place, can't be new and therefore can't be a basis for overcoming the time bar that would otherwise be applicable.
I mean, that is a little bit of an understatement of what's in the record, counsel. I mean, the record does indicate that your client testified that he was looking at hiring a private investigator at that time to look into false testimony by Ms. McPhillips. So he knew about it back then. And then, you know, to that point, you know, the state has cited a recent, by letter, a recent case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, Onyelobi. I take it you've taken a look at that case. I'd like you to comment on the applicability of that case on the newly discovered evidence exception.
Yes, I did take a look at the Onyelobi case, and I think the distinction in that case is that that doesn't deal with a recanting witness. If I understand that case correctly, what it involves is a defendant who had a co-defendant who was present at the scene of a shooting, and then when this defendant went to trial, the co-defendant never testified, and now after the fact, the defendant's using that co-defendant as a witness to essentially say that this defendant didn't take part in certain parts of the crime. And the distinction, I think, there is that they're dealing with evidence that was available and known to the defendant the entire time because the defendant was there with this other witness. This case involves a recantation, and even though she was there with Mr. Woodward, this individual testified and was really the state's primary witness against Mr. Woodward. And unless and until she recants, even though Woodward knows what she's saying isn't true, he doesn't have the ability to present that evidence, whereas the defendant in the Onyelobi, I think the Supreme Court says, could have presented that at any time. And so,
but I mean, the Supreme Court didn't limit its holding in Onyelobi to those circumstances. The Supreme Court says evidence cannot be unknown when the petitioner was admittedly present at the time of the events the witness purports to describe. So I'm having a hard time seeing why this rule of law is inapplicable in this circumstance, because your client was there with Ms. McPhillips.
I agree that he was there, but I do think there is a distinction just in the nature of a recantation and in trying to use sort of a co-defendant as corroborating defendant or corroborating evidence of innocence in a different capacity. And I know that I don't think the Supreme Court limited, you know, wrote its holding in a way that limited it, but I do think the facts are quite different in this scenario because, and I think that part of that is reflected in the nature of the Larison test itself versus the Rayner test for newly discovered evidence. And I know that the Supreme Court in the Larison test has said that the taken by surprise prong, which I really think correlates sort of to the fact that this witness knew the person was, or the defendant knew the witness was there and knew they didn't tell the truth, isn't dispositive. And so I think if there was a specific case that brought that to the Supreme Court's attention, our belief is that there would be a different outcome and that the Supreme Court would distinguish between just this sort of general use of somebody who was at the scene and known to have been there, and the fact where the state's primary witness has recanted against the defendant. And I think that's also reflected in the statutory time bar exception itself, which has the
counsel,
requirement.
Not to interrupt you, but if I may, the district court found that Mr. Woodward did not satisfy the due diligence prong for the exceptions to the two-year time bar that you're relying on. So would you address that? You've talked about the 2012 testimony, which gets us to 2010, but you haven't talked about the district court's determination, which seems to have ample support in the record, that this is a case where Mr. Woodward has always maintained that this now supposedly recanted witness was lying. In fact, that was his theory during the 2007 trial. So where is the due diligence? Because I'm struggling to see it.
I think the due diligence is present, Your Honor, in the fact that Mr. Woodward explained in his filings here that even though he had heard those rumors that he talked about in 2012 that McPhillips was recanting, and he did actually hire an investigator to try to make contact with Ms. McPhillips about that. And what happened was that his investigator received what I guess was sort of classified as a cease and desist letter from an investigator, a law enforcement investigator, that says, you know, Ms. McPhillips doesn't want to be contacted by Mr. Woodward or people on his behalf, and that this people should stay away from her and not contact her. And now I think we know from McPhillips's affidavit and also from the SASMA affidavit, which was submitted as part of these materials, that Ms. Woodward didn't really authorize, or excuse me, Ms. McPhillips didn't authorize law enforcement to take that step on her behalf.
And well, Mr. Longstorff, if I could stop you there, because I had the same concern about the due diligence requirement, the exercise of due diligence requirement under 501 subdivision 4B2 for the newly discovered evidence. And your statement that he just heard a rumor seems to be contradicted by Ms. McPhillips' own affidavit. On page 7, paragraph 51, she says, quote, during the spring of 2010, I was in the process and willing to come forward with the truth pertaining to the false testimony I provided during Mr. Woodward's trial. I made this willingness known to others, and I believe this message did get passed on to Mr. Woodward. So she seems to indicate that she was willing to come forward, and she let this willingness be known to others, and that Mr. Woodward knew about that. So that, in combination with his testimony from the 2012 trial, that he hired an investigator to look into this, that seems to corroborate each other and seems to indicate that he knew of this information at that time and could have filed a petition for post-conviction relief, asked for an evidentiary hearing, and then have her testify. I understand your argument that he didn't have an affidavit, but that sounds like it was more than enough information at that time for him to seek file a petition for post-conviction relief and ask for an evidentiary hearing.
Well, we disagree with the sort of the idea that he would be able to get an evidentiary hearing if he had filed that third party affidavit under those circumstances. Now, if we had a scenario where...
Why not? I mean, is there any case law that you can cite that would say that that would not be enough evidence? I mean, you've argued that it's, you know, relatively low bar. All you have to do is allege that you have information. That seems like more than enough to allege that information to seek an evidentiary hearing at that stage.
The case law that I think we would rely on that is there's a Miles v. State. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case. I think it's 2011. And what that case says, I think it says that it's got to be supported by more than mere argumentative assertions. And what they go on to say is that it requires some kind of sworn statement. And then there's a case.
Yes, I agree. Yes, I have read that case, and I actually have it up. And I agree with you that it requires more than just mere affirmance. But the affidavits don't have to be from that person. The affidavit could have been from appellant himself. It could have been from the private investigators that he had hired who had talked to her. But his affidavit alone may have been enough right there to get an evidentiary hearing to have her testify, especially when she herself in her own affidavit indicated that she was willing to testify in spring of 2010.
I think the distinction there is that there needs to be some firsthand knowledge in this scenario. And Mr. Woodward never heard from McPhillips herself that she was recanting. So if he did his own affidavit, he would be saying, I swear that this person told me that that person is recanting. And I don't think that that is something that's got sufficient indications of reliability that a hearing would be granted. And as far as the investigator, I think what the record that we've developed thus far shows is that the investigators never actually made contact with McPhillips because they received the cease and desist letter that said that she wants to be left alone. So I would agree that if there was, for example, an investigator who talked to this individual himself and could say, yes, I sat down with McPhillips, I saw her, I know who she is, and she recanted under these circumstances, I think that would be sufficient to get a hearing. But that's not what we have here. We would have always had this third, sort of this through a third party connection to an affidavit, which would have resulted in the denial without an evidentiary hearing. And then we are in a scenario where if Mr. Woodward later does get that definitive information because he can get in contact with her, or he learns that she really didn't say, you know, leave me alone and don't come to me, that he wouldn't be able to get a hearing on that claim. And so I do think that what has happened here shows that he's exhibited the appropriate level of due diligence.
I don't understand why it is that you're saying the cease and desist letter prevented further investigation. It certainly didn't prevent further investigation immediately preceding this post-conviction petition. So why is it that it was somehow an impediment for an 8-year period before that, or 9-year period before the current petition?
Well, just factually, what happened was that Mr. Woodward was attempting to make contact with this individual, and they received that letter, and his investigators then stopped trying to get in contact with her. And then he hired a different set of investigators, which down the road, and these were former law enforcement individuals who knew that they could still contact this woman, even in spite of that letter, which is what resulted in the discovery of this information. And so that's why he has it now, even though he didn't have it in the past. And I think, you know, the statute and also the interest of justice are looking for some kind of impediment or just the exercise of due diligence. And we believe that he's shown that he's done that here. Thank you.
All right. I see that your time has expired. You will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, sir. Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alexandra Meyer, and I represent Respondent State of Minnesota. The most straightforward resolution to this appeal is for this court to find that Mr. Woodward's third post-conviction petition is procedurally NAFLA barred. Appellant claimed as early as 2007, during his cross-examination of Ms. McPhillips at trial, that Ms. McPhillips lied.
Ms. Meyer, I hate to stop you so quick, but looking at the Minnesota Supreme Court case that you cited, do we even need to get to the NAFLA bar if we NAFLA procedural bar? Shouldn't we be starting with the statutory time bar? Because there they didn't even get to the NAFLA bar issue at the very end in the last footnote 5. They even said we're not even going to get to that issue because we have determined we hold that the statutory time bar is not met.
The state's position is that you could find this petition time barred or NAFLA barred or both, and it would just be your determination of the best way to analyze the facts here. Anya Lobey certainly throws a new spin on the way this case has proceeded. It's a very recent decision, but it clearly extends the legal principle that for exceptions to the 2-year time bar, newly discovered evidence is not newly discovered when the petitioner was admittedly present at the time of the events that the witness purports to describe. So, counsel,
Mr. Lonsdorf argues that that rule of law doesn't apply in a situation like, or shouldn't apply in a situation like this, where you have a recanting witness. Do you want to address that argument?
Yes, my response would be the same as to his argument that this court should be considering Larrison. Neither of those tests apply at all unless the post-conviction petition can get past the initial procedural and time bars. So until the petition qualifies to go forward under any of the 5 exceptions to the time bar or the 2 exceptions to the NAFLA bar, no further analysis even occurs.
But I think his argument is that it's newly discovered evidence, which would get him past procedural hump.
Well, newly discovered evidence is one of the exceptions, but Anya Lobey is talking about how the first prong of that the evidence is, quote, newly discovered, can't apply when that newly discovered evidence is, as in this case, something that the defendant knew of at the time of trial involving a co-defendant. That's very important here.
I understand what the case holds, but I think that Mr. Lonsdorf is making an argument that the case doesn't apply to the circumstances that are present here when you have a witness who's recanting. Do you want to address that?
So his argument is then essentially that instead of the newly discovered evidence exception, you would have to perform a Larson analysis first, which doesn't make sense.
Well, can I stop you there? I understand your argument with respect to the Larson test, and the Supreme Court in that case made it very clear that we don't even get to the Rainier test either, unless there's an exception to the procedural time bar or to the NAFLA. I'm sorry, to the statutory time bar or the NAFLA procedural bar, and I think this Minnesota Supreme Court made that clear. But I do have a concern about whether the rule of law in that case applies to a witness who has recanted, because if a witness testifies at trial and says, I swear that I saw him pass the drugs and that he had the drugs, but then if that witness somewhere down the road recants, I'm troubled by the idea of applying that case to a recanting witness, because that seems to be something new. You may suspect the person isn't being truthful, but you don't know until that person actually takes some type of affirmative step to state that they want to recant, that they provided false testimony. That seems to, at least the opportunity for that to be considered newly discovered evidence seems to be available still.
I don't think it is clear how Anyalobi, which is very new, would apply in the circumstance that we are potentially talking about, in which case this court can rely on any of the other reasons cited in the state's brief for denying this case. I would agree that it is concerning. It's not yet clear how Anyalobi would apply, except that it is a statement of the law from the Supreme Court that you now get to consider.
But, do we even need to consider it if we just look at what the statutory, follow the outline of applying the statutory time bar and whether or not those exceptions are met, including whether or not the appellant exercised due diligence?
Correct. That would be why I started with this most straightforward way to resolve this case is by saying it's NAFLA barred, because then you don't have to reach that analysis.
But couldn't we still reach that analysis by looking at the statutory time bar because of the requirement that appellant exercise due diligence, either petitioner or petitioner's attorney? It's not just limited to the petitioner. It could have been the petitioner's attorney who could have sought that information and followed up.
That's correct. And petitioner was, while he was pro se at his trial, he was represented by counsel on his direct appeal and at all three of his post-conviction petitions. And he obviously had the resources to hire investigators not just once, but twice. He didn't follow through by asking the investigators to pursue, for example, affidavits from any of the other witnesses. There are other individuals that had information about this case and that testified, such as Mr. Johnson, such as Robert Zilla, who provided an affidavit now. It doesn't sound like Mr. Woodward took any steps to try to speak with Mr. Zilla back at that time, or to Ronnie Turner, the other person present. The only thing he did is say, send his investigators to try to talk to Ms. McPhillips. And when he failed, he took no further steps for 9 years. And that does not establish that he acted with the appropriate level of diligence required to meet any of the exceptions. I would
If I'm following you right, counsel, your last remarks are addressed to due diligence, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so I would like to hear from you on the NAFLA bar when you're ready. I didn't mean to interrupt if you wanted to continue. I know all of these issues obviously overlap. So whenever you want to tackle that, I'd like to hear your analysis.
In 2010, Mr. Woodward hired private investigators. He filed a timely first post-conviction petition in 2011, and he was granted an evidentiary hearing in 2012, still within that 2-year time period. And at that petition, he called witnesses to testify. He subpoenaed one of the attorneys that had briefly represented him. He had the capability to call, he knew about this claim and he had the capability to take steps to have it heard before the court, and he did not take those steps. If, for example, as he continues to assert that the affidavits he would have obtained wouldn't have been enough, he could have challenged that decision on appeal and it would have been before this court. But he did not take those first steps. He knew of this claim and he could have and should have taken the necessary steps to file a timely post-conviction petition. Because he did not, the claim is NAFLA barred. I would briefly like to address 2 points raised in appellant's reply brief. First, he cites Miles for the proposition that the post-conviction court was required to take on face value statements in these 2021 affidavits. But if you look at Miles, the decision is actually based on the Supreme Court's finding that the post-conviction court in that case failed to point to anything in the record demonstrating that Miles could have discovered the information any earlier. In that case, Miles did not even know the witness was present. That's clearly not the case here. Also, the evidence presented in that case to the post-conviction court was an unsworn, unnotarized statement submitted by the defendant. Even in 2010, Mr. Woodward could have presented more than that to support his claim here, especially as part of that post-conviction petition in 2011, where he was granted an evidentiary hearing and called witnesses.
Ms. Meyer?
Yes.
Would it have been enough to file an affidavit from appellant, or would he have had to file an affidavit from the witness that he did hear?
Because he had knowledge at the time of trial that he believed the witness lied and that the state was involved in procuring this lie, a notarized affidavit of the knowledge and the basis of knowledge of that could have been sufficient, but certainly he had more information than that, including, I have heard that this witness is willing to recant, and I heard it from these sources who have reason to know. The more information he provided, the more likely that hearing would have been granted. But if you look at the transcript from the 2011 post-conviction hearing, Mr. Woodward was stating on the record when he testified all sorts of unsubstantiated claims to the post-conviction court, but he did not include this claim. He made many claims about what the state had done, how the trial had been pushed back time and time again to cause Ms. McPhillips to lie under oath. And all of those statements were brought before the post-conviction court, and he did not include this information, which he should have done, and obviously had a venue before the court at that time for them to hear it. I would also respond to petitioner's analysis of the Ferguson case. That case provides examples of what a petitioner could have done between 2010 and 2012. In that case, they found that the signed affidavit of an individual with knowledge that a witness recanted is sufficient for an evidentiary hearing. It's unclear who exactly would be providing that affidavit in this case, but the sources that told Mr. Woodward that Ms. McPhillips was willing to recant could have signed an affidavit stating that they knew this. And under Ferguson, that is sufficient to get an evidentiary hearing. Additionally, in Ferguson, he had filed a post-conviction petition, and that was on appeal when this new evidence came to light. He asked that this court stay the appeal. He filed an amended post-conviction petition where he then had the opportunity to present new evidence. Even if we're looking at 2012, after hiring investigators and with all the information he testified that he knew about in the Rice County trial, he had that opportunity to ask that he'd be able to add more to his 2011 post-conviction petition, and he did not do so. Mr. Woodward is not entitled to relief because he has squandered all the time and wasted all the opportunities he had to raise the claims he now brings more than a decade and two post-conviction petitions after his conviction was final. If there are no further questions, the state respectfully requests that you affirm the post-conviction court's denial of Mr. Woodward's third post-conviction petition.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Lonsdorf, we're just going to reset the clock. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I just have one further comment on Onalobe and whether it would absolutely preclude any opportunity at relief here. And I just think, as I think about it, if it's meant to apply in a blanket fashion to every case, if you have a scenario where there's a recanting witness, it would almost exclusively preclude relief any time that a witness recanted, as long as that witness had been there. And I just don't think that that's the intention of the decision. And I don't think that we should read that into it, because it would effectively eliminate that exception to the time bar for somebody who deals with a recantation like this. And then the other point I wanted to make is that I do think there is a second avenue to overcome the time bar, which is the interest of justice exception. And that has a sort of a similar component to the exercise of due diligence, but that looks for something that was an outside impediment to prevent the defendant from raising the claim earlier. And I think a way to look at this is Mr. Woodward had heard that this witness was recanting and willing to work with him. And when he went to get steps to do that, he essentially gets that letter that says, you know, McPhillips says leave her alone, which I think he can reasonably understand to believe that this witness doesn't really recant and maybe I'm getting bad information. And so I do think that there's an outside impediment there that has played a role in preventing Mr. Woodward from presenting that. And I do think, given the absolute importance of McPhillips's testimony to these convictions, because we have a scenario where after essentially 3 years of investigating Woodward, they got the 0.19 grams of methamphetamine from him on July 18th. And then there's the June 20th amount, which was 6.79 grams, but isn't for sure that it came from him because there was no, it's not like the, you know, it had to go through McPhillips into Johnson. And so without McPhillips's testimony, there absolutely cannot be a conviction because otherwise there's nowhere near 10 grams. And I think given the importance of her testimony in this case and the fact that she's recanted in a very detailed manner and provided these explanations for why she did so, including that she was threatened, that she's offered cash inducements, this is the kind of case where in the interest of justice, Mr. Woodward should be given an opportunity to have a hearing to present evidence in support of those claims. Absent any questions, I don't have anything further.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The matter is now submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Appreciate your submissions, counsel.